Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You might have seen this next guest in the lineup at Rincon or on stage at Madison Square Garden, but I know him from drinking in parking lots as a teenager. Every high school has a student that's considered most likely to succeed. They're academically dedicated, they're active in school politics or clubs or sports, and they're self-disciplined with a sharp focus on their future. That wasn't me, and that wasn't my friends either. Many of us were actually quite smart and creative in our own unconventional ways, but school spirit certainly wasn't what we cared about. Several of us would eventually find career success by way of some unexpected and circuitous paths, but one of us would become the lead guitarist for one of the biggest rock groups on the planet and subsequently find themselves just a single degree of separation away from another iconic band that transformed the entire music industry with a song called Smells Like Teen Spirit. There's a unique bond that you have with someone when you were friends with them well before they became wildly successful. There's a certain understanding that you have that puts you in a special category. You share memories and experiences that predate their current reality. But do fame and success have to fundamentally alter someone's behavior and personality? The answer is no. Chris and I still find ourselves hanging out in parking lots together, only now we're holding sandy wetsuits instead of beers. Life has a way of coming full circle. Today, musician, family man, surfer, political activist, and Santa Barbara native, Mr. Chris Shiflett.
That didn't fuck it up, did I?
No, we should be good.
Yeah, okay, cool. Check.
The last thing I want to do is hear you talk shit about my compression. Chris Shiflett, thanks for sitting down, dude.
Yes, sir.
Wow, that's funny. Kind of all back to where it all started here in Santa Barbara.
100%.
So I have been staying for the last 2 weeks at my parents' house, Basically in the bedroom that I grew up in, albeit with a wife and a kid now. But yeah. It's kind of funny. I think maybe you can go home again. I feel like not that much really changes around here.
You know what the good thing about being the age that we're at is that when you go home again, you only seem to run into the people that are like also like happy and kind of in a good place. Like all the jailbirds and fuck ups have all kind of fucked off to the corners or something. You know what I mean? You just don't run into any of it.
But it was funny, we were talking about the other day, like I keep out of the corner of my eye, like thinking that I'm seeing people that I know from high school, and
everybody.
I'll be like, oh wait, but that person's 28.
Well, it's funny because that's everywhere I go in Santa Barbara, and especially when I'm surfing, everybody I look at, I'm like, is that somebody I knew in high school? I did that the other day right down here at Hammond's when I looked at a guy just maybe a little too long because he looked like a dude named Brian that went to Santa Barbara High around the same time as we did. And I kind of did that thing where I just looked at him like a second too long and he was like, what's up? kind of like hard staring. I was like, you're bro from high school, you know?
So it's kind of funny. I feel like we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of a similar relationship with surfing in that, you know, we grew up here, grew up in the ocean. I surfed for a handful of years when I was a teenager and basically moved to high school, like essentially right out of high school. And then surfing didn't really have a place in my life until 30s when I kind of rediscovered it. And then by then I was living in New York City, and as cool as Rockaway is for this fun little surf scene, like, it's not that good that often. You know, like,
right.
After surfing Rincon with you yesterday, I'm just like, dude, what am I doing? That place is pretty magical out there.
You know? It's interesting. You know, I grew up at the beach. I did not grow up surfing. I grew up boogie boarding. You know, I'm almost like embarrassed to admit.
Yeah, but you know, water culture. Surfing. You know,
yeah, but just hanging out at the beach. You know, I grew up like on the east side of Santa Barbara, and so we could walk to East Beach, you know. And I was always kind of fascinated by surfing, but I didn't really start surfing till I was like into my 20s, you know? And once I started surfing, I was like, holy fuck, how could I have not been doing this my whole life, you know?
But did you have a conscious, I mean, cause you're a busy dude. You got the podcast, obviously you got the band, you got your solo career, three kids.
Yeah.
Like it'd be really easy to not surf, obviously. Like when did you decide to really like consciously carve out time in your life and make that a priority?
It's an ongoing thing. I mean, I really, like, honestly, like, there's been stretches in my adult life where I'll go a really long time without getting any waves because it's easy because of all the things you just said, but also because of traveling. You know, it seems like, you know, it's like Murphy's Law. Like, I come home, there's no waves. You should have been here last week when it was pumping, you know. And so it's easy. You can, if I'm in the middle of a tour cycle, I could go months without surfing because every time I'm home, there's no waves. And then I leave and then it's good. And you know what I mean? You just get one of those. And then, and you know how it is. Like, once you sort of get out of that
groove. It tends to snowball. It's like an, almost like has an inertia to it. The more you surf, the more you want. And then once you, like, I was out of, like, when I first came here, you know, 2 weeks ago for the holidays, like, I went down to Rincon just with the fam, and it was like not firing but like gorgeous, and like and I was like, oh, that looks cool, but like I wasn't even jonesing,
right,
I hadn't surfed for a while, and then I paddled out a couple times, and then now I'm just like, hey, sweetie, you think you could watch the kid, you know? Like, I'm just like, you want to get back in?
It's interesting, it's kind of cyclical, but like this year in particular, a couple things happened for me. First off, I was like touring a lot on my own, sort of sandwiched in between. It was like a light year of touring for Foo Fighters, but we were working, but not like, it wasn't crazy. It was sort of like off cycle, you know? And so between Foo Fighters stuff I was doing, I put out an album and like went, did a lot of touring on my own. And I sort of in the middle of all that, really right at the beginning of summer, I kind of had that realization like, fuck, I'm not going to have a summer. I'm like gone all summer, you know? And I'm not going to have any lazy beach days with my kids. I'm not going to, you know, it's just sort of like, didn't have an opportunity for any of that. And it kind of fucked me up. Like threw me into like a, like, I don't know. It just made me really depressed and made me like, start like feeling like resentful to all this shit that I had committed to that like was good stuff that I wanted to go do and, you know, going and working. But I was like, found myself like looking for reasons to not do it and looking for excuses to cancel shit, which I didn't do. But I guess my point is like, it sort of reinforced like, that I have to carve out that time when I'm home. And I have been like since then, basically. But also with sort of reconnecting up here, you know, I wanted to get over feeling like a fucking tourist in the lineup at Rincon. You know, I don't want to feel like a tourist at Hamilton. I still, you know, if I'm being honest, I still do, basically. But I'm just trying to get up here more and surf more and really get to know the sort of the lineups.
Well, I just feel like you have like the perfect level of kind of, for lack of a better word, fame and notoriety. Let's call it fame adjacent, you know, in a way.
right.
You know, and that, like, you have, like, all the perks of being part of this machine of the Foos and, you know, all the success and the perks that brings. But at the same time, without a lot of the trappings of having to be, like, that public figure. You
right,
know, you can walk down the street and you can, you know, live your life. But, you know, ironically, I feel like the one place where all that success and status and fame, like, doesn't really hold any weight is in the lineup.
Totally. You know? It might even count against you. I mean, I remember Timmy Curran telling me, like, when he would go, I don't remember which break he was talking about, but he told me about getting yelled at, like, you get to go on boat trips, we have to live here, like, that kind of shit. You know, I think there is an element of that. You know, for sure.
And is there anything about that equation that you would want to change? Would you like to be, if you could have your way, would you be, you know, less anonymous? Or is there a part of you that wants to be a little bit more of like, right this way, sir? Like,
no, you know,
like,
I think you nailed it. And I love that's what my life is. Like, I get to be a part of this big thing and make a good living and like take care of my family and tour the world. I've gotten to travel all over the world for years and years. But the fame part, I think the fame part maybe appealed to me a lot more when I was a kid. you know, because it's sort of like the fantasy of what being like a rock star when you don't know what it is.
Well,
you know
what's the biggest misconception that's now that you've kind of experienced that, if not personally, like kind of peripherally from Dave or other people?
Like, I mean, I think it's all who you are and how you handle it. You know, I mean, I think you look at somebody like Dave, he obviously does a really good job of like keeping things in balance, you know, like as crazy as, you know, probably a lot of his life is, you know, with especially nowadays, you know, with where the band's at and where he's at as a sort of celebrity. I don't know that they're like, you know, we grew up in a time when like, you know, rock stars were like Van Halen and Ozzy and people like that. And like, by the time I came along, I feel like grunge and 90s alt rock had had like made a lot of that like really like you would feel guilty about
it wasn't
living,
yeah,
like you know, like the, sort of wrung that out,
it was,
you know,
less cool to be famous and cool,
right, you know, unless you couldn't like, you know, smash hotel rooms up, not that I would have ever necessarily wanted, but like, you know, I could have when I, you know, was younger, I suppose I could have been as decadent as I wanted, but I didn't even join the Foo Fighters until I was 28, you know what I mean? And it was years before we started making like you know, the kind of living where you could go out if you wanted to blow your tour income on a Ferrari or some dumb shit. Like, you know, I suppose I could have done that, but I never did, you know? And then pretty early in all that, you know, I got married, started having kids and all that sort of thing. So it's sort of like, you know, I suppose I could live a crazier existence, and lots of people do, like, don't get me wrong, like there's plenty of like cocaine and strippers and shit going on in rock and roll that maybe isn't on people's Instagram account, but you know, it exists.
Well, it's because you've been able to maintain like your sense of like humor and humility and perspective, you know, and do you think it has to do with the age at which you joined the Foos? Do you think surfing has a part of that, or just like there's like kind of this sense of like humility and
Well, it's funny, you know, that you mentioned surfing and that, because certainly around here, you know, historically, it's like, you know, black wetsuit, whiteboard, shut the fuck up, kind of.
And all these rules that I don't even know, but dude, if you wrap your leash around your board right when you get out of the water, that's a kook move, dude.
Right, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah, I didn't know. Is there a handbook? But it's funny because I think that mentality extends certainly in like where we grew up in California, like that extends beyond the lineup. And there is a sort of like, you know, don't get too big for your britches thing that I think is part of the culture
the surf
growing
culture,
up here, you know? And, you know, that said, I think we all do stupid things, you know, through at various points of our life, but, you know, my family, my friends, my wife, certainly a big part of like keeping my feet on the ground. Yeah. You know,
if you walk in the house, it's like Chris Shiflett from the Foo Fighters. Like, that shit doesn't really fly.
Oh, my God, are you kidding? First off, my kids don't give a shit. Second, my wife's like, unpack your fucking bag and do the dishes, because you're not at the Four Seasons, bro. You know, there's nobody here to pick up after you. I mean, you know, Cara, it's like, she's like, you know, it's like being married to Sean Murphy or something half the time. She'll just throw you zingers.
So, like, I'm sure you've just crossed paths with so many just random luminaries of different, you know, fields and whatever. You know, they always say, don't meet your heroes. Like, do you have a certain experience that really proves that? Have you met anybody? You're just like, what the fuck is that? You know, without naming names or with naming names.
Nothing too bad. I would say most of the time in those environments, you just sort of don't have a meaningful conversation with the person.
It's just
person
kind of like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. Right, like, show is good.
Right, like Jimmy Page came out to a Foo Fighters show years ago. He's like, been to a few. I mean, he came out on stage with Dave and Taylor, you know, at that Wembley gig years ago. But like I remember one time when he was there, maybe it was the first time or whatever, and it's fucking Jimmy Page, and you just so badly want to go have that moment, but so does everybody else. You know what I mean? It's like the whole backstage is smothering him, and you know what I mean? So that's not like, you know, necessarily a bad experience, but it's just sort of nothing. But like, there's been a few people, I would say like Kris Kristofferson was like maybe one of the coolest experiences, because we did a thing with him at a Johnny Cash memorial right after Johnny Cash died. We played Sunday Morning Coming Down with him, and he showed up. You know, most people have at least a tour manager and a guitar tech or something. He showed up nobody. Wow. He showed up carrying. He walked into the rehearsal room carrying his own guitar and was just like, hey, what's up?
Which is exactly what you would say.
Exactly what you would want, you know what I mean? And then he hung out and we played a couple, ran through the song. He's like, all right, sounds good. And then he just hung out all day, you know, that's like cool. Until the show.
And it's cool that you mentioned him in terms of a name because, I mean, he's obviously a legend and, you know, famous, and but it's not the most famous person. I guess the point I'm saying is that it's really the ones that kind of get to you are the ones that actually mean something to you, right. Not necessarily just the like arbitrary level of their fame, you know, like, because those are just, I've crossed paths with some of those too, and it's just like, you're kind of just like, oh, that's interesting, because you get to see the actuality of the disconnect between like the image and the person, and it's you know, it's novel, but it's not really meaningful a lot of times.
You know, I grew up as like a monster Kiss fan, like just monster Kiss fan, and Paul Stanley's kids go to the same school as Dave's kids, and so we've done like a couple things where Paul Stanley has come out and played with us, but we played at the Forum for Dave's birthday a few years ago, and Paul Stanley came, did a couple songs.
I think I was there. They did all the covers, like the.
Yes.
Like the,
I was, oh, were
the,
you there?
Yeah, I was there with They did like the Jane's Addiction guys were there.
Yes. And yeah. Like tons of people came, but it was like for me. I mean, that was like. There's been a few things, but like that was one of the great all-time moments for me because, you know, the Forum is where Kiss Alive 2 was recorded.
Yeah.
And like we sound checked with Paul, and he's like the nicest guy in the world, and like a super. He's so pro that at sound check. I swear to God, he was sound checking his like between song banner. Like, the Forum is empty, and he's on stage with it going like, "All right, Los Angeles,
I can't hear you."
Like he was doing the whole thing.
That's awesome. It's pro, man.
It's
show,
super
it's
pro
show business.
Yeah.
I guess the funny thing is, I feel like the I guess civilian population has this notion that once you become famous, it's like this kind of secret door that opens and everybody knows each other and it's fraternal and everyone's on the same level.
Right.
It seems like, in fact, it's just like every other part of life where there's like cliques and stratum and all that stuff. And, you know, from the perspective of, you know, getting to shoot a lot of famous people over the years, like one of the most charming and interesting things for me to get to experience is when people who are legitimately famous are kind of humbled and a little starstruck by other people that are legitimately famous.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, you realize no matter who you are always 13 at some point. And there's always that one person that was like coming up ahead of you that you emulated. Like, have you experienced anything like that? Have you ever seen Dave starstruck? Like, have you seen him on his heels?
For sure, because, you know, it's a funny thing, especially in recent years. Like, there's been so many, like, you know, when the guys from Queen come around or when we did that Sound City, when Dave did that Sound City movie and we, you know, went out and did a bunch of shows around that and all these, like, special guests came. But, I mean, they've got so many. Like, and... you know, Dave still obviously, like, you know, he grew up listening to like a lot of underground music and punk rock music. So a lot of those folks, like the guys from fucking Naked Ray Gun or whatever, come out to the show, and you can see that he
means
like,
something to him.
Yeah, means something. The guys from Bad Brains come out, and you can tell that moves him in a way that maybe, you know, meeting Joe Schmo Rockstar doesn't.
It's fascinating too because most of the kind of true mavericks of seminal cultural movements like that, whether it's like skateboarding or punk rock, like the first generation never made any money. And so it's interesting, you know, that you see someone like these, like even I got to shoot, you know, Jay Adams briefly, you know, a couple years ago before he passed. And I was like, he was literally, I think he was like a busboy at Cholo's on the North Shore. You know what I mean? It was like, kind of, he'd had some issues. And I think that contributed to it as well. But I mean, these guys they're not filthy rich.
Oh, you know? Now what's his name? What's his name now? I'm drawing a blank. You know, the dude that was like the Zephyr Surf and Skate.
Oh, like, that's a writer or
Skip.
Skip. Yes, yeah. Skip Fry.
Yeah. Yes. He Skip Engblom. Skip
Engblom.
Skip Fry is that other Shaper dude. Yeah. But he, you know, he was like probably still is doing ding repair down in Marina Del Rey or whatever, you know what I mean?
Like, Conlon's tied with him.
Yeah. Oh really?
Yeah.
I mean that's like an age old story, you know, whatever it is, you know. Yeah. It's, you know, surfing, boxing, music, you know, whatever.
So tell me, is that a strange transition going from, you know, being Chris from the Foos playing stadium and then being Chris the solo artist and playing, you know, bars and small little clubs? I mean, that's is that a huge transition? I mean, it must be very bizarre.
It's usually feels like it is more for people like at, you know, I get more comments from people like, oh my God, you're setting up your own gear, you know, that sort of thing, you know. For me, it's like playing little clubs and bars. It's like, I never stopped doing that through all the years. I always had like a little side project or something, you know, outside of it. And, you know, that's like where I, that's where everybody comes from. Music, the place rock and roll. It's like we all grew up in bars and keg parties and stuff
like that. Is it a little bit more fulfilling on some level just because it's something that you completely created by yourself as a powder stuff? I mean, you're obviously at this point, you've been with the Foos enough that you're part of the creative force, but there is a sense of there's like this inertia of the machine that you kind of jumped mid-trip, you know?
Yeah, it's like, the difference between being like, you know, a teammate, you know, or with Dave's obviously the creative force behind the band. And so, you know, you're sort of playing to what he wants out of his own songs and all that sort of thing, as opposed to just like getting up and, you know, sort of playing maybe a little more intuitively or whatever, you know, whatever. Yeah. And I think it's very different when you're playing songs that you wrote with words that you wrote that have part of your story. And you know what I mean?
It's a lot more on the line.
Yeah. It's such a different role, you know, for me in that thing that, you know, it's, I love that I get to go out and do it. I like that I have both, you know.
I mean, I guess
I'm super comfortable in a support role in a band. It's mostly what I've always done, whether it was like high school bands or like when I was in No Use for a Name or even the Gimme Gimmes or something. And certainly with the Foo Fighters, that is a comfortable role for me, like in a band. But I like to go out and sing and write songs.
And the muscles, it's a different muscle flex for sure, right?
Totally.
Like, how do you maintain like a sense of enthusiasm? You go on a like long tour like that and you're playing the same. I mean,
that's the hard part.
I know. I'm just saying, like, really like how tired part. Must Dave be of playing Everlong? And he wrote it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
from you,
like, how do you, I mean, there must be nights you just kind of try and phone it in, or like, how do you rally to give that to the crowd?
It's funny because, I mean, really, without sounding too corny about it, you really just have to find the fun and the unique moments in every show. And the thing about that people maybe don't think about with like a band like the Foo Fighters, like, this sounds awful to say this, but like, we basically never have a bad show. You know what I mean? Every show is like, people are there to see us.
That's
and they
a fair
sing
statement.
Along.
That's why they're there to see you. I think that you guys have that reputation of like,
right, but like, you never go out and like, we're not trying to win the crowd over in the same way. It's a very different thing when you're playing music that people know and have like listened to for years and years, and they know all the words and they're shouting along and it's a different kind of like expectation of what the show is. I think, you know, that is one of the the thing that's the most radically different. You know, there's the obvious stuff of like, if I'm out there as Chris Shiflett, the solo artist, I'm playing to 50 people in Des Moines or whatever, you know, opposed to like a stadium. That's sort of the obvious thing. The maybe less obvious thing is that when you're out playing songs that nobody's ever heard, a room full of people that are like, we don't know who the fuck you are, and we haven't heard these songs, especially if you're like supporting somebody else. That's the thing that I fucking love. Like, I love having to win that crowd over in the way that feels. You know what I mean? That's really fun. It's a different thing. I also love going out and having fucking 20,000 people go know what I mean? It's like, but it's a very different animal.
There seems like a little parallels. I heard like a lot of stand-up comics talk about the difference between, you know, doing a set at the store or, you know, to a random crowd and then doing a headline show. It's like, you don't have to win the crowd. The people bought tickets and got sitters and waited in line to see you specifically.
Oh, and they're rooting for you. Yeah. They didn't come out to have a shitty time. They don't want to be bummed. They want to, you know, they're like there to, you know, especially like a big Foo Fighters show or something. I mean, people like fly in for those, you know. It's like, it becomes it's an event, you know, it's a trip to meet up with all their friends. And, you know, it's like, they're not there to go, oh, this sucks, you know. It wills you on almost, you know.
So I don't know if you remember this, but one of the first date I went on with my wife, Lisa, was to the Foo Show.
What?
Yeah, you know, I think in New York, New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Listen, I mean, it would have been, I can do the math, it was 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, you hooked me up, and like, so many things could have gone wrong. It was like, oh, the tickets weren't there. You know, I'm just like, oh, there's a lot on the
Which
line.
Which often
like,
does go wrong.
But, no, everything went smooth, and, you know, you've always been super, you know, generous and gracious. so he like came and met us and like hooked us up or like hanging backstage. I'm kind of feeling like, oh yeah, I'm the man. And I'm like kind of just like starting to get a little relaxed, get some drinks in me. And then, you know, you're like, oh, by the way, we're about to go play a rock and roll show if you want to go watch. like brought us to stage. And I remember kind of like peeking behind the curtain and like looking at the crowd, and I was like, holy, I had this epiphany. I was like, holy shit, you all are popular. You know? like, it's just like a really weird thing when like someone that you know from a kid becomes like this other thing, you know? But yeah. At the same time, I think that's why it's always so great to hang out with you, because you aren't that other thing. You know, you're still just this dude I'd known forever.
It's interesting because, you know, as you know, a lot of people we grew up with sort of never left. And, you know, there's that whole thing. And there's almost like different categories of friends, you know, and like you're one of the people that went out into the world, went far away and did some crazy shit, yeah. You know what I mean, with your life, and have lived a lot. And it's interesting because like throughout that whole time, whether it was like, you know, my band playing at a keg party in high school or whatever, which you would have been at, or the Red Barn or what, you know, whatever, one of those things, or like, you know, like hanging out in New York in the mid 90s, like at those like No Use for a Name shows, like Coney Island High or whatever, like the early Warped Tour stuff, or any of those things, you know what I mean? You sort of like, we've always connected through the years through all the different points. It wasn't like I hadn't seen you since fucking, you know, 11th grade, and then all of a sudden it was,
you're like, oh, he's famous, can you get me backstage, right, you know, or whatever.
It's funny, I think about that sometimes, like we've sort of like, there aren't a lot of my friends that I know through the whole thing.
It's funny. I remember when you were doing the Warped Tour, and we went and hung out with you, and I was like, oh, you know, I was like, oh, my friend is starting to get a little, you know, level of status. He's on tour or whatever. And I came to meet you in the afternoon. You're like, dude, I'm basically in a concentration. I'm like a refugee camp right now. I'm in the middle of this like dirt field with no transportation. It's 2 o'clock. We don't go on until fucking whenever. And like, it's not that glamorous, you know?
Didn't we like take the train back from like Roosevelt Island or some shit? Like, I have like a vague memory of that. Like me and you and maybe like John Bush and some people all being on a train coming back from the Warped Tour.
I was like, I thought you were a rock star, dude. What's going on?
Where's the white limo, bro?
Oh man! So I pulled up a couple of photos on the way over here, and one of them is one of you and Joan Jett.
Backstage
in New York, and it's just so funny because my first concert ever was for my 6th grade birthday gift. My parents took me to see Joan Jett at the Arlington.
Yeah,
and then cut to probably late 90s. I was a photo assistant. I worked on a shoot with her, and there was a kind of quiet moment afterwards. And like, I wanted to kind of pay like respect to her, and you know, say, hey, you were the first concert that I ever went to when I was in 6th grade. But like, somehow the way it came out is like, you are so fucking old that when I was in 6th grade, I just like totally botched it, you know?
Right.
So then cut to today, and like, I honestly don't remember doing it, but you know, like when you sign up for a security question for a credit card, they say, oh, school, first school you went to, pet's name. Like, what was the first concert you went to? I must have said Joan Jett. So literally every time I call my credit card company now, like, has to be represented. Joan Jett, representative.
Yeah.
I was just saying, so ridiculous.
That's funny.
But it's really fun to get to shoot you guys. I think that must have been the Sound City project. What was that for?
No, I feel like that was backstage at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that was first time that we did anything with her. Because I remember those pictures too. I feel like that was before. I could be fucking that up. I don't know. I'm fucking senile, but I feel like that was before the Sound City stuff. It's interesting because, you know, Pat has known Joan Jett forever.
Like, did he produce the record or no?
She produced
Germs.
The Germs record. But even before that, he was like a teenager running around, falling around the Runaways. You know, like way back when.
Wow.
It's funny. I don't remember her ever sort of being around in the early days of being a Foo Fighter until I feel like that was the first time.
I think it was right around the same time. And then, so it was cool getting to meet her. And then I remember we hung out when Mike Ness and Social Distortion were supporting you.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember that great story you told me about him. I'm sure I'm like going to butcher it, but you're like, somebody was like talking shit and like whatever, but rather than like just getting into an immediate fist fight, they basically made an appointment to go and like go down the block and have a fist fight.
Yeah.
And then they like brawled it out. And And then the guy's like, all right, cool, we did that. You mind giving me a ride back?
Yeah.
Is that right. The gist of the story?
Yeah, it's funny. I should make it clear that I heard that story very secondhand, not
so
directly
I'm telling
from
it fourth
Mike.
Hand, yeah, but it's
yeah,
a great story.
I didn't
story.
Hear it from Mike Ness. But, yeah, I suspect that it is true. But, yeah, that, man, getting a tour with them, like, I mean, that's like kind of goes back to what you were talking about before, meeting people that like I was always such a massive fan of Mike Ness and Social Distortion. But also like he's one of those dudes that you're kind of afraid to meet because he's got a gnarly.
He's real.
Edge,
he's real.
You know? Yeah. And I got to say, like, because I interviewed him for my podcast kind of early in doing it. And he was so fucking cool.
What kind of a deeper dude than I expected.
So much deeper.
I remember that
totally,
podcast.
Yeah,
I was like, kind of like, wow.
Totally. He gets into all kinds of stuff. And he's just a thoughtful, just what a sweet, cool, thoughtful guy, you know. But obviously, you know, has an edge to him.
But another one of those characters that, you know, from that era that we look up to is like kind of Mount Rushmore of punk rock
totally.
Or whatever. And like, I don't think he's, I mean, probably got a decent life. He can, you know, like as a tour, you know, touring lifestyle, but like, he's not filthy, you know, like they didn't make a ton of money.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I don't, he looks like he lives pretty great. You know, he looks like talk about a good level of fame and success.
Yeah.
That looks like a pretty like, you know, it's manageable, but like, I mean, the guy kind of like, created a subgenre of punk, you know?
Yeah.
That, like, there's, like, a whole... There's, like, will always be generations of, like, greaser punk rock dudes following in that image,
yeah,
you know?
And kind of the first person to really, like, draw what would actually be a really obvious parallel, but I'd never seen, you know, between, like, country... And punk rock, you know, like Johnny.
Yeah.
I was like, I never thought of, you know, Johnny Cash or people from that genre as like having a direct lineage to what we were into until, you know, someone like Mike Ness.
I would say for me personally, he's probably maybe the most influential in turning me on to that, you know, old honky tonk and stuff like that. Because they would cover some of those songs and stuff. Yeah. But like, you know, I didn't grow up listening to old country music, and it was through, you know, through Social D and certainly like through X, you know, some of the stuff that was around in those days that turned me on to just even thinking it was cool.
Yeah, or even like what other punk band from the time would do like a Stones cover? You
right.
know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
not,
totally.
Wasn't like
yeah.
a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you were supposed to hate those people, not celebrate them.
know? Which is funny, too, because, like, dude, so I got in the last, like, basically when my wife was pregnant, it was, like, oh, it was a Steely Dan pregnancy. Like, it was, like, the most, like, it just, like, represents everything I needed in my life.
Yeah.
Just, like, smooth and mellow.
Very and, like, well-crafted.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it was just, like, that was the shit you were supposed to hate back in the day. Now it's, like, I'm like, dude, I need some, oh, this is a Steely Dan Sunday right now.
You it's know, funny the, how, like, there's some things that that I grew up hating, just like a visceral hatred for, like anything sort of hippie related, you know, and it's growing up here, summer fucking solstice parade, and there's just hippies everywhere, and sort of that post-hippie culture that we were just sort of surrounded by, which made a lot of us, I think probably you too, like just fucking despise anything patchouli. Like, it was like a big move for me that I could like smell patchouli oil and think, like, oh, it smells kind of nice now. You know what I mean? Like, it was like real progress.
It just reminds you of like dirty girls with no shoes on.
Totally. Or like to be able to listen to like a Bob Marley record or something, you know what I mean? And appreciate it. Like, was like kind of, but there's some things from that era that I can't let go of just sort of despising. It's funny how like some things you're okay with and some things you're not. Like when all the sort of like soft rock, retro soft rock started happening a few years ago and people celebrating that era of like,
you're like
70s.
I don't really need Seals and Crofts in my life.
I hated it then. I don't think it's hip now. If I could have fun, but I fucking hate it still.
Well, so that kind of leads me to the question. I want to get your perspective on the music industry as a whole. Like, I know the economics have obviously changed, but like just for me personally, I find that like music just, it's sad, but it doesn't hold the same place in my heart and my life as it did when I was a kid. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, growing up around here, there were certain cultural signifiers. You'd be like, oh, that guy's a certain haircut. Oh, that guy has creepers. Like, okay, we have something in common.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't just the music. It was more like, and it was an identity as well. And I think a lot of that, I don't know if it's just us getting older or me getting older, but I feel like that isn't really as much a part of music, period. And then also you have so much competition with Instagram and video games and whatever that means. It just doesn't have that kind of cultural driving force that it did, at least for me. Like, yes. What's the state of the music industry? Is it on its last legs? Is it thriving? And I'm just that old dude. Like, where do you see it?
From what I understand, the record industry is thriving. But like, it is interesting what you said about cultural signifiers, because I noticed that mostly just with my kids and watching what they're into and what all their friends seem to be into, and I just sort of look around their school and I don't see a lot of subgroups. I don't see goths and mods and skinheads and punkers and heavy metal. Like, you know what I mean? There's a little bit of that stuff here and there, but it's certainly not the way it was when we were kids, which, you know, yeah, I don't know what's better or worse. I know that I liked it better the way it was when we were kids, but, you know, it's because I lived through it. But I think part of it is also, like, I think your relationship with music changes a lot because, you know, when I was 10 or when I was 16 or even up until into my 20s, you know, early 20s, like you sort of, you want to be defined by the things that you're into. I'm a fucking Jawbreaker fan. I got this shirt and I go to the show and you don't fucking know what this is, but I do. And it's my little thing that's mine, you know, or I'm into Kiss and fuck you if you're into Aerosmith because Kiss is the best. Blah, blah,
and there's so much, I don't know if it was everywhere or just here, there was so much of that, like growing up in Santa Barbara. Like wearing like a Black Flag pin and then some scary dude comes up and goes, you need to tell me three Black Flag songs right
totally.
Now. I'm going to kick you. You don't deserve to be, you're not in the club. You know
what's great about that time, like when we were in high school, and I feel really lucky because I look back on it and I go, God, I fucking listened to some horrible shit. I listened to stuff that was good that I still like, but I listened to a lot of horrible shit. But just by virtue of hanging out like in the junior parking lot around all the people that we were hanging around, you just got turned on to everything. Like whether it was, you know, all the punk rock stuff. Like I never really identified as a punker dunker. Like I wanted to be a glam rocker. You know, I was trying to do that. But like you got hooked, you got turned on to all the punk rock stuff, all the ska stuff, like goth stuff, you know, all the skin.
Because it was a small enough of a community where they had the influences of, you know, from LA and, you know, people were into cool shit. But it's still a really small town. Yeah. So you're talking, it's the same 200 people that were hanging out downtown.
Right.
You know, this dude had a shaved head. This dude had a mohawk. This dude was in the sky. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was like, there was like these factions, but it was still small enough for like, we're still kind of all in this together against whatever the others were.
The kids in the big dog shirts.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
a Corona Beach Club or something.
It's interesting, like just by virtue of like what was on your friend's tape deck in their car, like on at the keg party, you sort of got turned on to all this, you know, your musical education was vast.
Yeah.
And like I find myself like, you know, like reminiscing about stuff that I wasn't even really into at the time, but you still know it sort of front to back.
And that's what's interesting about, you know, going back and revisiting some of the music that meant a lot to me at that age. And it's like, some of it didn't really age very well. Or maybe it wasn't. Which makes me think that it probably, it's not that it didn't age well. I don't think it was that good even back then, but it just represented to us more than the sound on the record, you know, is about like, oh, we're part of this culture by listening to this.
And like you're so open to it at that point. You know what I mean? You're just a kid. You don't have a mortgage. You don't have kids. Yeah. You don't have a fucking job. You don't have any stress in your life, really. Like, it's just different. You know, I think, like, I still love music and music is, you know, a huge part of my life. And, you know, it's the thing I do for a living and all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, I'd be lying through my teeth if I said that I listened to it with the same intensity that I did when I was a kid. Not even at all. not even close. Like nothing moves me like that. But it's probably just because I'm old and desensitized.
Formats change, like the whole singles culture and online and streaming. Like, I used to know title tracks and liner notes and, you know, stuff meant something.
I used to know who mixed the record and where it was recorded.
A square
and all that
foot
stuff.
Of artwork. Yes. And now it's not, it's a thumbnail picture.
We're definitely getting into like get off my lawn territory here for sure. but whatever, you know, I mean, I'm almost 50, so I can do that. But I think it's so weird to see how my kids, you know, get turned on music. Cause you know, when we were kids, you would go buy a record and you just, that was like the record that you had, and it was your latest record, so you'd just listen to it all the time, and you just knew it, you know, maybe you'd tape it, and you know, your friends would tape it, whatever. And it would be, you know, months would go between record purchases. Now, if you're into something, it's like too fucking much. It's too much for me, and I'm a grown man. Like, I can only imagine what it's like for my kids. Like, how do you process anything?
Or even get to, like, for me, I feel like music is almost like making a new friend, as corny as it sounds. Like, I keep my circle pretty small, and then, you know, every once in a while I let somebody in. It takes a long time for me to feel like really comfortable with them. But once I do, it's like familiar.
Yeah.
And I would do that with a record too. Like, it'd be like either not into that, or like, I'm gonna listen to that 12 times in a row, and like,
right,
I'm gonna get to know it.
Right.
Now we're friends. Now I'm familiar with it.
I think that's.
And I feel like I don't do that anymore.
Well, that's a part of the problem. It's like nobody listens to it 12 times, because a lot of great records you have to give it like 3 or 5 or 10 spins before it really fucking hits you. You know what I mean? I remember that, like, even something that to me doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess it kind of is, like, what was it? Radiohead, OK Computer, when that came out. Like, I bought it, listened to it once. I was like, yeah, it's all right. And then I was like, yeah, listen to it again. Yeah, it's all right. And then by the third listen, I was like, well, there's something happening there.
Yeah.
And then by the fifth listen, I couldn't stop listening to it till the 1,000th listen. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, when's the last time you did that with a record?
It's been a while. I did actually the last Arctic Monkeys album I really liked a lot.
It was
worthy of that multiple listenings. And I feel like a lot of stuff today, like, that's not even the intent.
But that's probably just our age talking, and not because, you know, my kids listen to whatever it is that they're into fucking over and over.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. So,
but
like,
they don't listen to the album. They listen to the song and they get about 3/4 of the way through.
Music
and they move on to the next
music
one.
Does have that place in their life, like, the really,
oh, for sure.
Oh, that's cool.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. And I think in some ways they do kind of identify by it. You know what I mean? But it seems more like, what's the word I'm like? It's just like less focused in a way.
Did they get a good kind of music 101 education from you that stuck, or did they against that?
We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, yes, they did. You know, for years, my kids just sort of, especially my oldest son, Liam, cycled through various chunks of my record collection, you know, whether that was like AC/DC, or there was a Green Day phase, there was a long Kiss phase, you know, some stuff that I was like, I fucking did it. This totally worked, you know? And then they were just sort of forced to listen to, I always marveled at, like, they somehow, before they, I don't even think, really knew what genres were, they could recognize when I put on, like, a country song and immediately shout it down off the stairs. Turn that, don't, no, we want to hear, you know, fucking The Hives or whatever, you know? But they were forced to listen to all of it. And then I remember when the Beatles box set came out when my kids were really small, like maybe even, I don't know if I had all three of them yet, but I bought the Beatles box set and I was like, I'm going to put this on repeat.
Yeah.
I'm just going to play this all the time in the house. And I kind of did that for a while just to, like, you just got to get that good bass,
it really does
bass
kinda,
layer.
It's such a good bass layer. I mean, like, my son Jasper is just like, he's a huge Beatles fan, and it's just like, it represents everything, like, kind of music 101 that they should learn. It's like, it's melodic, it's funny, it's well crafted, it's artsy, it's non-linear in some place. You know,
totally.
It's just like a really good starting place to
100%.
Go to the next.
As a musician, that was my really the bedrock of, like, my music theory knowledge, because I was lucky. My first guitar teacher made me learn those songs, and at the time I was like, I want to learn fucking Iron Maiden, fuck the Beatles, like, you know what I mean? I like the Beatles, but like, it wasn't
cool.
What I was into in fucking 1982 or whatever, you know. So and I'm just glad that he did, because that's where I learned all my, like, chord voicings and all that shit, you know. But it's interesting, because now my older two kids don't really listen to guitar music at all. You know, they listen pretty much exclusively to hip hop, which is all good. And then my youngest is totally still in the phase of listening to my rock records. So, and he's stubborn, so he might be the holdout.
So I pulled up this picture, and we'll close on this. I don't know if you've seen this picture before. It's kind of like a perfect metaphor for, it's you in the hot sun carrying shit up a hill with your family. That is a perfect metaphor for being a dad.
That should be called parenthood right there.
But here's the key thing, with a huge smile on your face.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, I had an even bigger smile on my face the day that I realized that all my kids were out of car seats, all my kids were out of strollers, and I just cleared all that shit out of my fucking garage. The greatest.
Yeah.
That's funny, dude. I kind of remember that trip. I remember when the fuck was that? My kids look like they're very young in that. Like so
6, 7, 8 years ago.
It's so funny, you know, those early days of parenthood are like there's a lot of sort of self-created stress. No, oh, we gotta have the this and the that and blah, all that shit. God, I miss it now.
Yeah.
I really miss it now. You know what I mean? Like my kids are, they're teenagers. They're big. They're independent. You know,
like you're actually at that point where time is starting to speed back up again.
Yeah.
I just got past the point where it was like, I remember when my son turned 2, people were like, oh, he's 2 already. I'm like, no, that fucking feels like 2 years. Like that's a long 2 years.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah.
It's starting to kind of speed up again.
How's that sleep deprivation going? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you're probably through that now.
Oh my God. I mean, he was pretty good. Honestly, the hardest part for me was just before he started speaking. I was, you know, my wife and I are both freelance. And so I was with him a lot and he was at that point where just like, dude, you need to get some new material. Like, I'm more bored than I love you right now. Like, get it together, dude.
Oh,
you know,
funny.
And now we're kind of at a weird point now where it's like he's fluently speaking, but it's like he's not quite old enough to be saying super interesting things, but
right.
old enough where it's not a novelty that he's talking all the time.
Right.
Well, like, kids, I get it.
Okay. Kids go through that like drunken college kid phase where the, you know, when they're toddlers, where they're like bumbling into everything.
Yeah.
And like, it's that's when it's hard. But God, man, I'm at the other end where, you know, we still have a few years left, but like my oldest is driving, you know, we only have a couple more years with him till he's going to be out of the house, off to college, whatever, you know, it's like, I find myself getting fucking, I'm like sad about it right now. You know, like it's funny, just, you know, we were up here for a week and it was great. And, you know, obviously my Cara and I have a very different relationship to Santa Barbara than my kids do. Cause they're not from here. They didn't grow up here, you know? So we just want to be here all the time. And they're like, fuck, we just want to go home. And so they had it, you know, Cara took them back a couple of days ago. And when they were getting ready to leave, I was like, I'm going to get all this shit done. I'm going to finish all these little projects that I have to do up around here. And the second they left, I was just like, oh, where'd they go? You know, like it's like rips your fucking soul out. You know?
I feel the same thing. Like we just be like so exhausted and so, oh, let's get it. And you finally put him to bed and then just like sit down and like, oh, I'm like, let me just look at Instagram. I'm like looking at old videos of him,
right,
like,
yes.
in the other room.
Oh, yeah.
But
that's one thing I found my kids don't. They're not old enough to be nostalgic about their childhoods yet, because I do that. If I'm on tour, I'm like looking through my phone and then I text it to them like, oh, look how cute you were. And then no response.
Yeah, it's funny. One of my Jasper's favorite things to do is look at Jasper videos. He likes to look at videos of himself.
Oh, nice.
Am I raising a little narcissist?
Yeah, perfect. Perfect for the times.
Yeah, totally. But like, it'd be interesting to see the effect that has on memory recall.
Right.
Because like for us, like there was kind of home movies and maybe we got like the beginning of a video, but for the most part, like we had some still pictures in a shoebox, and that was our memories.
Where yeah.
it's like you have the ability to record and document basically entire life, you know, and how that kind of affects their memory. Because he says he remembers stuff when he's like 2 years old,
right?
I don't know if it's from seeing photos or.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't trust my memories anymore. You know, I've come to realize that they're faulty. But and a lot of it is constructed from old photographs in the shoebox at my mom's house. But it's interesting, like being a photographer, have you like hyper documented your son's childhood so far?
Yes and no. I think I started it first.
It's just a higher quality of documentation than the rest of us.
I think me in general, like I grew up on film, and so I'm pretty economical with
right.
the way I shoot photos.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not from this perspective now where it's just like blanket, you know, take pictures. It's
yeah.
so easy to take photos now on your phone or even a real camera. Or it's like I come from the era of every time you push this little button, it costs $1.
Right. Right. Yeah, so don't fucking press
it
too
much.
What
are you trying to say with this photo? And then now it's like people, like they forget that, yeah, okay, sure, you can take 1,500 photos over the course of a party, but like you still have to parse and edit all that information,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
And so I think editing and camera is like something that is a fine art that's been lost.
Well, it's interesting because it's also like yeah, I find the older I get, the more I'm uncomfortable by clutter.
Yeah.
Any kind of clutter, old shit in my garage, whatever it is. And that, and like digital photos make me stressed. You know what I mean? There's just too many of them. Like, somebody has to come up with a really, like, maybe they already exist. I don't know. I'm kind of a Luddite. But somebody needs to come up with a way of, like, organizing all your fucking, the overflow of fucking digital content that we all generate.
It's crazy. I mean, it's funny. There's, like, a definite cutoff on me, like, because I toured with a lot of bands and did a lot of, you know, celebrity kind of photography, but it was almost all on film. And then the time when I switched to digital, like, my archives, I'm pretty organized and keyworded. I can find stuff quick, but, like, somebody will call me and be like, oh, I'm looking for a picture of, you know, Outkast from 19. I'm like, nah, sorry. I'm not going into that closet.
Right.
Find the contact sheet, find the corresponding neg, get a scan. Like, it's not going to happen, you know, unless it's like there's real money involved or if it's something that I really care about. But, you know, on the flip side, like, somebody with this surf project that I've been doing, you know, like, I could pull up most surfers by their name and, like, email them a photo within 2 minutes. So, you know, it definitely is convenient. It's just, it's a different workflow for sure.
Yeah. So it drives me nuts.
Well, dude, man, thank you for sitting down. Thanks for the fun time, some fun waves.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, let's do it again soon, man.
I'm glad we got some good hang time on this trip.
Right on.
Thanks, boss.
Yeah. Good shit, man.
That was great, dude.
Good shit.
That was fucking great.
This episode of The Plug was produced by Bucci with audio engineering and original music by Peter Buckingham. Thanks for listening, and a huge thanks to today's guests for dropping in. If you like this episode, hit subscribe and be sure to tune in for future conversations.
And don't forget to post your job for free at linkedin.com/surf. That's linkedin.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.